third credit agencies about the debt crisis and the World Bank. And I'm happy to present to you, to my left, is Mara. She's from Jubilee 2000, Mara Renderfleisch from Jubilee 2000 US. And here we're having Neil Watkins. He is from the Center for Economic Justice, and he's also working with 50 Years is Enough. And then we're having Aaron Goldzimmer. He is from the Environment Defense Fund in Washington. I invite him, Neil, to start to speak about the World Bank. And we really want to try to find out how are all these topics linked to each other, because we do know a lot about the World Bank. We've heard about the debt crisis, but we don't really know how they are interlinked and what transnational corporations have to do with this. So I'm happy and curious to learn about that.
Thanks a lot. So my name is Neil Watkins. I work at an organization in Washington called Center for Economic Justice. I also work a lot with 50 Years is Enough Network, as Christine mentioned. And I'm going to start out with to focus a little bit on the World Bank. I'm sure many people here are at least a little familiar with this institution. Certainly has been the subject of a lot of criticism and concern, and in recent years, protest at their annual meetings. And I just want to, as I was putting this together, I was thinking, wow, there's certainly a lot of issues the bank is involved in, and a lot of concerns people have. So I just want to, rather than going on forever, talk about kind of a few of the key trends, look at some of the history and background of the bank, and focusing on the World Bank's power, look at some of these trends that have been emerging in the past 5 or 6 years there, look at the ways the World Bank is now financing dirty industries, like the oil, gas, and mining sector, and continuing support for dams, and then finish up with a little bit of an uplifting note, at least I hope, on resistance and ways that people are challenging the institution. And I think, though it certainly has a harmful record, I think one thing that we can all be happy about is that more and more people are learning about these institutions and their role in doing something about it. So I'll start by just talking a little bit about the background and history of the bank. Now, the bank was founded in 1944, originally in an effort to provide reconstruction loans for Europe. Over the years, its role has changed a lot. Through the 1970s, then President Robert McNamara increased World Bank support for investment projects around the Global South. And I'm gonna give you the super fast history here. In the 1980s, we see more lending for what's called structural adjustment loans. People may be familiar with that, but I'll talk a little bit more about that later. So that now the bank is a combination of what many people associate the bank with: big dams, large energy projects, superhighways, project financing like that, but also really being involved in the way that the economies of impoverished countries work through these structural adjustment loans. The bank has four main arms, that is, four main elements to it. One is called the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development. This is the IBRD. This is the biggest branch. It makes about 80% of the World Bank's loans. And it's financed by bond sales, which private investors buy in private financial markets to provide the funding. And I'll get back to that a little bit later. The other branch which loans money to governments is the International Development Association, or IDA, which makes loans at very low interest rates over a 40-year payback period. And this is only available to the poorest countries. There are also two other branches of the bank which lend money directly to private corporations. These are the International Finance Corporation, the IFC, and MIGA, the Multilateral Investment Guarantee Agency. When you say the World Bank, you're actually talking about kind of all four of these things, and hopefully that will kind of, as we all of us probably refer to these different branches, that'll become clear. In order to understand the bank and the IMF's role in the global economy, I think it's always helpful to me to think of it in terms of the power that they have and the way that their structure really centralizes power in the richest countries at the exclusion of the poorest countries. So the IMF and World Bank are governed on the basis of essentially $1, one vote. The bank is run by a board of directors which represents member governments. but the number of votes you have on that board is based on how much your contribution is to the bank. So when the bank was started, the U.S. contributed about 17% of the bank's capital. As a result, when there's a decision about whether to approve a project or a loan, the U.S. has 17% of the votes. Together with the other G7 countries, the total is about 45% of the vote controlled by the richest countries. For all of sub-Saharan Africa, all those countries combined have 7% of the voting power in the institution. So I think that's an important context to think about when there's certainly a number of bad projects the bank has, but a lot of it goes back to the way that I think the power is concentrated there. The IMF and World Bank, especially the IMF, play a very central role in the global economy. And the way that I think it's easy to understand this is to think of it as a sort of creditor's cartel. The International Monetary Fund is the central element of this creditor's cartel. Let's take an example of a country like Senegal in Africa. In order for Senegal to get access to credit from, be it the World Bank, the IMF, the African Development Bank, private financiers, they basically have to get a seal of approval, a green light from the IMF. If they're not moving along with the IMF's policies, if they're not agreeing to what the IMF and World Bank have spelled out for them in their loan agreements, that green light will not be made available, and they will not be able to get access to this credit. So this is true for especially the very poorest countries, about the 60 poorest countries. It's to some extent true for some of the middle-income countries as well. So just to give you a sense kind of where the power resides in these institutions, it's very hard for countries to kind of escape the policy requirements of them. Another really important issue at the bank and the fund is the way the debt plays a role as a mechanism of control. And I'm not going to go into this now because there's Mara will talk more about the debt. But I think because so many countries are indebted to the IMF and World Bank, it's very difficult, again, for them to avoid listening to the bank or taking the bank's advice. So that's a little bit about the background. I want to move now into to address something that often comes to people's minds when you hear about the World Bank these days, which is, haven't they changed? Right? The bank has made a lot of changes, or so it says, at least in the past 5 years. The bank's president, Wolfensohn, regularly criticizes protesters, saying, these people don't know what they're talking about. This is a totally different bank than it was 5 years ago. Well, I'll definitely disagree with that, and I think most of you probably would as well if you look at the record. But there have been some changes at the bank, and I'll just mention a few of them. One, there's now an inspection panel at the bank. This allows people that are directly affected by bank projects in a negative way to actually, if the bank's management allows to hear the complaint, they're actually allowed to petition the bank for grievances. This is the work of years of efforts by environmental groups, by other NGOs, to force the bank to basically make this part of their operating process. But it's an important thing, and it has been very useful for some of the more problematic projects. Another way the bank has changed is they have put in place a series of safeguard policies around key issues like forestry or the rights of indigenous peoples. And that, again, has been the work of years of activism and organizing by watchdog groups, by groups in the Global South, by NGOs. Problem here is now we're actually seeing a little bit of a rollback of these safeguard policies, where the bank is trying to downgrade them from safeguard policies that they have to agree to just best practices or things they're going to try to do. So actually, a lot of groups now are engaged in kind of rearguard battles just to keep what they've already gotten. And then just one other example of a change, so you don't think that I'm just telling you all the bad stuff. The bank in September 2001, again, after a long effort and long campaign, agreed to stop promoting user fees on access to education and healthcare. For 15 years or so, the World Bank has been telling countries and mandating in their loans that they have to move from what were often previously free healthcare services available to the poorest people to user fee systems, whereby you actually have to charge anyone that comes to a health clinic for access to care. The logic is there just isn't enough money to provide health care for people. People have to pay for it. The result of this has been quite devastating across Africa, South Asia, and elsewhere over the years. But again, thanks to years of work, an actual law passed by the U.S. Congress last year required the U.S. executive director to vote against any loan that had these user fees. And in September of this year, the bank dropped it. Again, this is a total victory. The World Bank is still promoting user fees on access to clean water. So there's still a fight that is going on there. And of course, the legacy of 15 years of poor people not being able to access healthcare is still there, and there's a lot of work to be done to overturn the user fees that already exist. So I think there have been some structural changes, but I think the common theme here is that it takes a lot of work and a lot of action by organized people in order to force change at the institution. And I think there's a long way to go on some of the fundamental issues, which I'm going to get into now, like the structural adjustment policies, the debt. There hasn't been as much progress. And I think those are some of the areas where we really have our challenges and our work cut out for us in the next couple of years. So what are some of the trends as to what's happening at the World Bank right now? I just want to talk briefly about three of them. First, there's more lending going to private corporations. Second, there's more of what I've been calling adjustment loans. And finally, we're seeing an increased move towards privatization of social services. So I'll just talk briefly about each of those. First, there's more lending going from the bank directly to private corporations. Again, this is through the bank's private sector arms, the IFC and MIGA, primarily, as I mentioned before. And not even that, the IBRD, the main bank branch, is also spending more money than ever to basically guarantee private sector investment for corporations. And you'll hear that this is also happening. This is essentially what a lot of the export credit agencies are doing as well, guaranteeing rights of private corporations who make investments in developing countries. The bank's growing focus on the private sector is basically corporate welfare. There's little connection to, for example, giving a loan to a large U.S.-based corporation to build a hotel, and this has actually happened in some IFC projects at the bank, to reducing poverty. It is effectively a means of transferring funds directly to corporations. Just to give some of the more egregious examples of corporations that have gotten money through the IFC or MIGA, Intercontinental Hotels, Westin and Marriott, Coca-Cola, Citigroup, again. So the move towards private corporations certainly belies the bank's claim that they're focusing more and more resources on the poor. A second trend, disturbing trend, is the bank is focusing more and more on so-called adjustment lending. Now, adjustment lending, there's basically two overarching categories of loans that the World Bank has. There's investment lending. This is lending for these large mega projects like your dams or your oil and gas pipelines, other things like that. And there's adjustment lending, which is basically fast dispersing money that goes straight to the government. But in order to get that money, the government has to agree to dozens, often hundreds, of economic policy conditions. So what kind of conditions do they have to agree to? It's a list of basically the dream of anyone who's promoting corporate globalization. They have to agree to budget austerity. Have to, and the IMF plays a very key role in all of this, they have to tighten their monetary policy, which often makes it harder for small businesses to get access to credit. They have to eliminate government subsidies for things like food. They have to privatize government-run industries or utilities. And this ranges from everything from telecommunications to electricity to water. And in country after country, you see rates for these basic services going up as countries have to privatize. You're seeing promotion of trade and investment liberalization, the policies of these organizations like the World Trade Organization, the World Bank effectively locking in the policies promoted by that institution. Another key element is labor market reform. These are policies where protections for workers, minimum wages, collective bargaining rights, all of those things are seen as anti-business, anti-foreign investment climate, and they have to be removed as part of structural adjustment. I'll give an example of what structural adjustment is, because I think all these kind of this laundry list can often be kind of overwhelming. But right now, the World Bank has been focusing a lot on structural adjustment loans for water privatization. The World Bank has policies that require the government of Ghana to increase fees for water and to lease the water system to foreign transnational corporations. These are large water corporations like Vivendi or Suez in France. A recent IMF and World Bank loan condition on a structural adjustment loan to Ghana mandated a 95% hike in water fees back in May 2001 as a way to prepare the system for privatization. So I think these are some of the things that it's often hard to understand or often hard to get information about. The bank does not publicly disclose its list of structural adjustment conditions. There is no transparency in that sector. So it's very hard to get information about this, but I think the record is certainly troubling. Just to give a sense of what the overall record of structural adjustment is, the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington did a study 2 years ago looking at the rate of increase of per capita income growth in two regions, in Africa and Latin America. And they compared two periods. The first period was 1960 to 1980. And this was a period of not extensive involvement by the IMF and World Bank in their economies. And then they compared the period from 1980 to 2000 in both of these regions, a time when structural adjustment became effectively the way of development. In the period from 1960 to 1980, you saw a 34% increase in per capita income in sub-Saharan Africa. For the subsequent period since 1980, you've actually seen a 20% decline in per capita income across the continent. This is kind of the starting at very low income to start with. So I think that the record there is clear. In Latin America, you saw a 73% increase in per capita income in the first period before extensive IMF World Bank structural adjustment programs. And in the second period, you've seen just an increase of 7% over 20 years. So that is certainly only one indicator of an economy's success, but it is the indicator of how the average person in the economy is doing. I think the record there is not good. So a final trend that it's important, I think, to look at is the trend towards privatization of basic social services. The World Bank is now considering adopting what it's calling a private sector development strategy. This would basically require the inclusion of the private sector in all infrastructure and social sector operations in the 78 countries that get loans from the International Development Association. That's the IDA part of the bank. This would involve including the private sector in services like healthcare, like education, like water and sanitation. This has obviously got people very concerned because I think there's a growing movement around the world and indeed in this country, which is saying that basic commodities like healthcare, like education, like water, like sanitation, should be rights and not commodities to be bought and sold. And this move by the bank to really consider this PSD strategy, as they're calling it, private sector development strategy, is cause for concern. The implications of this would be to undermine the concept of a right to these services, and many people think it will also lead to separate and unequal public services as corporations pick the most profitable of the different sections of the utilities or whatever to service, whereas the poor and the least profitable systems continue to suffer from lack of access to services. So those are some of the key trends within the bank right now. I want to focus now, just as I kind of come to a close here, with looking at where the bank is on these large projects in some of the dirty industries that generally, when people think of the World Bank, think of, well, big dams or oil pipelines or superhighways. And the bank is actually has changed its setup a little bit. It is doing less lending for investment projects and more for adjustment. But at the same time, you're seeing continued support for some of the most really heinous industries out there and corporations. I want to just look at two. First, oil, gas, and mining projects. Again, despite some reduction, the World Bank Group currently devotes 20% of its lending to energy projects. And the overwhelming majority of these projects are for projects that extract or burn fossil fuels. Between 1992 and the present, World Bank approved funding for more than $18.5 billion in oil, gas, and coal extraction and power projects in developing countries. So there are, of course, severe impacts of this funding. At the developmental level, a recent study by Oxfam showed that the more heavily countries rely on oil and mineral exports, the worse they actually do in health and education outcomes. Another impact is, of course, on the environment. There are so many well-documented oil spills, toxic emissions, and other effects that envelop local communities when an oil, gas, or mining project financed by the World Bank is set up. And then at the global level, the Sustainable Energy and Economy Network recently did a study which shows that World Bank fossil fuel projects financed from 1992 to 1998 will ultimately release 37.5 billion tons of carbon monoxide, which is an amount greater than all current annual fossil fuel emissions. And in that sense, we're all victims of the bank's financing for fossil fuel projects, because we're all going to pay the price of global warming. People may be familiar with a recent bank-approved project, the Chad-Cameron Pipeline. This is an example of a project the bank has approved back in June 2000, along with a consortium of major corporations, ExxonMobil and Chevron. It's a $3.7 billion oil well and pipeline project. The pipeline will cross an area of largely intact rainforest, and is also going to lead to wildlife poaching, deforestation, and it's going to impact the livelihoods of indigenous people in Chad and Cameroon. So again, despite some reduction in these areas, we're still seeing the bank financing this oil, gas, and mining work. And I'll get to some of the resistance piece of this, the hopeful piece of this in a moment, but there is right now a global campaign going on calling on the bank to phase out support for oil, gas, and mining lending, and actually doing that right away. The bank, of course, is resisting that, but I think that's something that there's an opportunity to really push them on in the coming year. The second area of really focus on the bank support for dirty industries or harmful projects is dams. Again, people may be familiar with some egregious examples in the World Bank's history here. The bank has been the largest single source of funds for large dam construction around the world. The World Commission on Dams estimates the bank has provided almost $75 billion for 530 large dams in 92 countries. It has promoted and funded dams that have displaced more than 10 million people from their homes and land, and it's, of course, caused severe environmental damage and pushed borrowers further into debt. Lending for dams at the bank has declined since the mid-1980s, and this is largely, I think, a credit to anti-dam struggles, water, and environmental groups around the world that have been highlighting the impacts, the harmful impacts of these large dams. But they're still being built, and more the bank is pushing them again into their private sector, arms, especially the IFC, the International Finance Corporation. Just this past December, the IFC approved a dam called Bujagali Dam in Uganda. It's a loan to the U.S. corporation AES Corporation, which is the largest, I believe, producer of power in the world. The dam will destroy Bujagali Falls, which is a culturally significant falls in Uganda. And it's going to be a bad deal, actually, economically for Ugandans. It will not bring electricity to most Ugandans, as 95% of Ugandans are not actually connected to the grid that the dam would pump power into. And it's going to actually drive up tariffs for those who are connected to the grid because of the capital costs involved in constructing the dam. So we see that even though years of lessons are out there about why large dams aren't successful, unfortunately we're still seeing the bank promoting these kinds of projects. One other project which is important to mention is the Lesotho Highlands Water Project. Again, another bank-funded dam, this time in the tiny nation of Lesotho, which is a country surrounded by South Africa. It's a massive multi-scheme dam, which is diverting water from Lesotho to service the industrial region around the South African city of Johannesburg. It's going to dispossess more than 30,000 rural farmers of lands, homes, and fields. And what is, again, most disturbing about this is that the water is going basically to serve the needs of the corporations around Johannesburg. It is going to the suburbs, the leafy suburbs of Johannesburg, where generally the rich live. Meanwhile, in Soweto, which is the township in outside of Johannesburg, right now people are actually losing access to water as part of a government and World Bank advised privatization scheme. So you have these big projects, and the argument is, well, we need to get water to people, we need to get access to water, but the water is actually not going to people who need it most. So obviously, this is an institution that, again, though there have been some pushes and some important changes made, that there are some fundamental issues around debt, around structural adjustment, around the role of these institutions, providing direct support to corporations who don't need it, around still financing these oil, gas, and mining and dam projects. I think there's still a lot of work to do. But I want to end just on a hopeful note, and that is that people are taking this increasingly, I think, in the global north, us here in the US and in Europe and elsewhere, and in the global south, there is really exciting signs of resistance, of challenge. It's not only the World Bank, but other institutions promoting this model of globalization. Let's give a few examples here. In the global south, and Mara will probably talk more about this, there's a really amazing new network of groups working to challenge the debt and structural adjustment, which is Jubilee South. This is a global network of groups that are challenging the very legitimacy of debt coming from an institution that promoted projects that have been of very little benefit in many cases to people in countries affected by these policies. I'll give another example. In South Africa, as I mentioned, in Lesotho, in November 2001, there was a protest of more than 2,000 people at the site of this Lesotho Water Highlands project. These are people all affected by the dam who came out and said, you know, you promised us compensation, you promised us we would be resettled and have a decent living, and that has not come through. So you're seeing more and more resistance like this. And I also mentioned a few examples of water privatization. I think this is an area where global civil society is really fighting back as well. In April 2000, for example, a huge coalition of campesinos, of trade unionists, of human rights activists and students basically threw out Bechtel Corporation from the city of Cochabamba, Bolivia. And Bechtel Corporation was, through a World Bank loan, basically granted the concession to sell water in Cochabamba, Bolivia, which had sent rates skyrocketing. And a huge popular protest sent that company home and sent the World Bank advisors who had pushed this home as well. So that's certainly a sign of hope. In Ghana, as I mentioned, where this water privatization is happening, there's a huge national coalition comprising religious leaders, trade union students, called the Ghana Coalition Against Water Privatization, which is also challenging the putting of natural resources, of essential basic services like water, in the hands of corporations. And of course, people here probably are aware of growing resistance in our own countries, in the North, in the US, in Canada, in Europe. Certainly demonstrations of the past few years have helped raise the issue on the public screen. Demonstrations like the one planned for this weekend will continue to raise these issues. There's work that is being done in Congress. As I mentioned, this victory last year, whereby a congressional law put pressure on the bank to drop its support for these user fees, is going to be followed up this year by a big fight around a replenishment of the bank's IDA arm. And Mara will talk more about that, but there'll be a lot of opportunities to push the bank further, to drop water privatization, to go after the debt, and to keep pushing the institution on all of these different issues. And then I'll talk briefly as well about a growing campaign here, which my organization is working on together with a coalition of people across this country and around the world. Most people don't know it, but the bank actually gets 80% of its resources, that is, the IBRD branch, is funded almost completely by the sale of bonds to private investors on financial markets. So we founded a campaign in April 2000 with people from about 35 countries across the global south calling for this campaign. It's based on the fact that, again, the bank raises its money on private financial markets, and we're organizing institutional investors such as city councils and governments, trade unions, religious investors, socially responsible investors, and mutual funds to commit not to buy World Bank bonds. And we're asking them not to buy World Bank bonds until the World Bank fundamentally changes. We're talking about an end to debt slavery, talking about an end to structural adjustment, and an end to these projects, these environmentally destructive projects such as oil, gas, and mining, and dams. So far we've been quite successful. 5 U.S. cities have passed resolutions adopting the boycott. We've worked with dozens of trade unions, religious investors. We've worked with investment firms to control about $15 billion in resources to get commitments not to buy World Bank bonds. We also know the bank is listening up to this, in addition to the other strategies, which are also very important to pursue at the same time. The bank is now sending staff out to city councils when there are hearings on whether or not to invest in World Bank bonds. They're lobbying. They're going on TV and radio to talk about why this campaign is harmful. But we see that as a sign of success, that the bank is actually feeling the impact and that we can continue to push the bank on this front. And if you'd like more information on that, I'd be happy to talk with you after. I have some materials which I'll have up here. So just to summarize, I think the challenges are great at the level of trying to change this institution, of working together with all the other institutions out there like the IMF to also change these institutions like the export credit agencies. And I hope that both the events this weekend, the events down in Porto Alegre at the World Social Forum, will inspire us all, because it's not just what's bad out there, but we are creating alternatives, we are creating resistance, and we're going to keep building that into the future. Thanks a lot.
Aaron, please continue to tell us what ECAs are and how they contribute to the crisis. Thank you.
All right, thanks, Christine. I just want to begin with a little exercise. If you could just raise your hand if you'd heard about the World Bank before you came here today and some of its problems. What about if you heard of the IMF, some of its problems? The WTO? How many of you had heard about export credit agencies before you came here today? Oh my God. Wow. We're doing better than that. Well, for those of you who don't and those of you who do, I'm here to explain them to you and tell you why they are such a big problem and why you should know about them. Okay, one more quiz. How many have heard about the Three Gorges Dam in China? Yeah, probably most of you. Perhaps the biggest and most controversial construction site on the planet right now. It costs $24 billion. Some have estimated that it'll end up costing close to $100 billion. It will create a massive public health risk because it's one of the most heavily populated areas in the world. And you're going to have all of that residential and industrial pollution, that most of which is untreated, goes directly into the river and now is flushed out into sea. But when you stop it up with a dam, it's just going to all collect there and create a public health and pollution nightmare. Yeah. The same thing with siltation. If you've ever seen the Yangtze River, it's completely brown. There's so much silt and dirt in the river. Once again, when you stop it up with a dam, many experts predict that the dirt will just collect behind the dam until you essentially get the world's most expensive waterfall. And that will obviate any power production or transportation benefits that people are hoping to get from the dam. The reservoir will flood limitless acres of arable land. Some experts have estimated that there's a 1 in 1,000 chance of a dam collapse. And again, in one of the most heavily populated areas in the world, a dam collapse could mean tens of millions of deaths. And that's not even counting the possibilities of a terrorist attack or a military targeting the dam. And most important, just in the near term, and this is a certainty, it's not a matter of probability, 1 to 2 million people are being forcibly evicted from their homes and villages to make way for the rising water. Now, the World Bank, as Neil mentioned, finances a lot of bad projects. But here's an example where the World Bank actually discreetly told China not even to ask it for financing because of these social and environmental controversies. Export credit agencies, beginning with the export credit agencies of Germany and Canada, stepped right in with hundreds of millions of dollars of financing for the Three Gorges Dam. So this is just one example. The planned Ilisu Dam in Turkey that would forcibly displace 78,000 ethnic Kurds. And it was also rejected by the World Bank, by the way. The Terry Dam in India. Scores of mines, oil development, et cetera, are all ECA-backed projects throughout the developing world. There are 19 nuclear power plants being built in the world today outside of G7 countries. The G7 is the group of the seven most industrialized countries in the world: US, Canada, Italy, France, Germany, Japan, etc. 19 nuclear power plants being built outside of the G7 in the world today. 14 of them are being financed by the export credit agencies of the G7 countries. So what in the world is an export credit agency? ECAs, export credit agencies, is shorthand for Export Credit and Investment Insurance Agencies. And they're essentially public agencies, public or quasi-public agencies, all of the rich country governments have them, that subsidize a country's exports and foreign investment. So if you are Siemens or any other huge multilateral corporation, a multinational corporation, and let's say you want to, if you're Siemens and you want to sell the turbines to the Three Gorges Dam, you turn to your country's export credit agency for financing. In that case, Germany's export credit agency. Or if you're Enron and you want to build a power plant in India that at the time of its arrangement in the mid-90s was the single largest foreign direct investment in India, and it led to massive human rights abuses and could bankrupt the state government. If you're Enron and you want to build this power plant, you turn to the export credit agencies of the United States, which are called the Export-Import Bank and OPIC, the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, for nearly $700 million worth of financing. So these are public or quasi-public agencies that exist to subsidize and support a country's exports and foreign investment. They provide direct loans, insurance, guarantees of commercial bank loans, all different kinds of financial services, usually under much better terms than a commercial or private bank would ever offer. So let me give you an idea of the scale of the impact of export credit agencies in the global economy, because it's hard to underestimate. Roughly $400 billion of exports every year are backed by export credit agencies. That's nearly one out of every $8 of world trade. And the vast majority of the big infrastructure and resource extraction projects in developing countries, of the kind that Neil was explaining that the World Bank also finances, the vast majority of them, roughly at least $55 billion a year worth, probably more, are also backed by export credit agencies. And just to give you a point of comparison, Neil explained that the World Bank, although it still finances some complete monstrosities, is slowly moving away from these large kinds of projects with completely adverse and horrific environmental and social impacts. Export credit agencies are picking up the slack. So at least it's a 1990 to 1996 average, this $55 billion a year figure. That's it could be much higher now. The World Bank's entire annual commitments are in the neighborhood of $20 billion a year. And as Neil was explaining, that much of that is for structural adjustment, and then throw in some health and education projects, etc. So it's only really a few billion dollars a year that the World Bank does in these big, huge infrastructure and resource extraction projects. ECA is $55 billion a year, at least. So when you talk about these kinds of big projects in developing countries, it's really ECAs that are the big, crucial players. So I just want to touch briefly on some of the other associated issues and problems with export credit agencies. Globalization. I mean, there's a lot of debate about what that word means and if it's good or bad, if the word means anything. But what's usually not understood is the extent to which government intervention in the international economy is responsible for it. In other words, it's not just the proponents make it out to be some sort of natural process that results from technological change and communications technology and transportation technology. But remember, export credit agencies back financially nearly one out of every $8 of world trade. So the government is having, through export credit agencies, this massive intervention into the world economy that's driving the increasing trade and capital flows behind globalization. Moral hazard. This is a huge problem associated with ECAs. Remember, ECAs provide loans, they guarantee private bank loans, they insure investments. These are all ways of absorbing risk. And in most transactions, in many transactions, ECAs back at least or up to 95% of the risk for a particular transaction. This creates a huge moral hazard problem, because if you're a bank, if you're an exporter, if you're an investor, and you get all of the upside from a potential transaction or a potential deal, a potential investment, and the government, the taxpayers, through an export credit agency, is taking 95% of the risk, then what incentive do you have to examine, appraise the transaction, see if it's a good one or bad one, do any due diligence or risk assessment? Very little. And so we have anecdotal evidence, actually, of from commercial banks, large private banks, where people tell us, you know, if it's an ECA-backed transaction, we barely even bother looking at it. Just go for it. The debt crisis. 56%, I mean, barely anybody realizes this, 56% of the official debt held by developing countries is owed directly to export credit agencies. This is much greater than the amount of debt owed by developing countries to the World Bank and the IMF combined. And there's three ways that developing countries contract this debt. So an ECA, let's say the ECA of the United States, could loan money to a developing country, let's say India, to buy our exports. It can guarantee a private bank loan to a developing country to buy our exports. And if there's a problem with repayment, the export credit agency will reimburse the private bank that it guaranteed, and then that debt passes to the export credit agency, and now the government of India will owe the export credit agency money. And also, export credit agencies very often insist on counter guarantees from developing countries. So even if a transaction is an entirely private sector transaction, let's say it's a private electricity company in India that wants to build a power plant, and an ECA is providing some form of financing to help it buy United States exports or any northern country's exports, that northern ECA will often insist that the developing country government counter guarantee that transaction. So if something goes wrong and there's a problem with repayment, the developing country will then have to repay that loan. So those are the different mechanisms that through which 56% of the official debt owed by developing countries is export credit agency debt. Now that doesn't account for, when I say official debt, I mean debt owed to official governmental, multilateral or bilateral bodies. So this includes the World Bank, IMF, multilateral bodies, bilateral aid agencies, all of the money owed to governmental or multilateral institutions. This doesn't count purely private debt that's owed to Citibank or Chase Manhattan Bank or anything like that. Global warming. Much of the fossil fuel and the fossil fuel infrastructure and fossil fuel extraction projects and infrastructure in developing countries is financed by export credit agencies. And so Neil gave a similar statistic to the one I'm about to give, where he said that the World Bank between 1992 and 1998 financed basically the same amount, financed projects that will contribute to global warming to the same extent that one entire year's worth of global CO2 emissions would. Well, this is a similar statistic. The fossil fuel, power, and oil and gas projects in developing countries backed by just the export credit agencies, EXIM and OPIC, of the United States between 1992 and 1998, over their lifetimes, will release virtually the same amount of carbon dioxide, about 30 billion tons, which is roughly the annual global emissions in 1996. And that's just one country, that's just the United States export credit agencies. In 6 or 7 years, financed projects in the developing world that will contribute to global warming the same amount as one entire year of global emissions. And just on the global warming note, I mean, this points out a tremendous hypocrisy on both sides of the transatlantic debate on climate change. Because the Bush administration has rejected the Kyoto Protocol, as you know, partly because it says that there are no requirements that developing countries reduce emissions. But at the same time, the US, through its ECAs, is financing the projects in developing countries that lock in higher emissions there. And from the side of Europe, the European nations that claim to be most aggressive in wanting to do something about climate change, through their ECAs, they're doing the exact same thing. Greenpeace just came out with a study that said that the annual emissions of the projects financed by the export credit, by England's export credit agency, have emissions equal to 1/3 of the entire emissions of England. So, I mean, the northern countries, while we say we're trying to do something about global warming, we're financing emissions in developing countries in incredible proportions. Arms exports. Many export credit agencies finance, I mean, it's sort of hard to believe, but I mean, actually finance arms exports. So until recently, half of the portfolio of the Export Credit Agency of England was devoted to financing the export of arms. And there were incredible scandals associated with that, the arms sales to Suharto in Indonesia and many other disgusting things. Nuclear power plants, I mentioned that 14 out of the 19 projects being built in the world today outside of the G7 countries. And then we get to the local, social, and environmental impacts, direct local impacts of ECA projects. This is the kind of thing that I was referring to before with Three Gorges Dam and that kind of thing. So this is involuntary resettlement, pollution, environmental destruction from dams and mines and oil development, etc. As Neil pointed out, the World Bank still finances some incredibly bad projects, and there are a number of projects that are actually jointly financed by the World Bank and one or more export credit agencies. But after 20 years or more of pressure from civil society, as Neil also mentioned, the World Bank has adopted a certain degree, a certain level of reforms. I mean, Neil mentioned many of them, but there's also just basic sort of environmental and social procedures. You have to do an environmental impact assessment in certain categories of projects. You have to make it public. You have to have some degree of consultations in certain cases. Now they often don't work, or they're inadequate, or they're poorly complied with, as Neil said. But at least it gives us citizens something to hold the World Bank accountable to. Now the World Bank, it's not just the World Bank, it's all the other development banks, it's the aid agencies, it's every other kind of public institution that finances these kinds of big projects in developing countries, except export credit agencies. Because remember, export credit agencies, it's not even in their mandate or objective. I mean, at least the World Bank claims that it's out there to help poverty in the third world. Export credit agencies could care less, right? I mean, they're just there to promote a country's exports and foreign investment. So most ECAs do not have any meaningful environmental or social standards or policies or safeguard procedures. And they routinely finance projects that even the World Bank has rejected. So you know that it's bad when even coming up to the level of the World Bank would be like a huge improvement, right? So there's been a rapidly growing international campaign around this issue. I mean, in the bigger scheme of things, this is really a new issue. NGOs, civil society, only began even tracking on this maybe 5 years ago, and it's only really in the last maybe 2 or 3 years that really large numbers of groups have gotten involved in the North, in Europe, in Canada, in the United States, in Japan, and in the South, in Asia, and Africa, and Latin America. There's many different avenues that we're trying to pursue. One of them has been just to get the ECAs to get up to the level of the World Bank and all of these other institutions and get them to adopt some degree of environmental and social policies and standards that we can then use to hold them accountable to. So far, they've refused. Instead, they've negotiated a grotesquely weak proposal in the OECD, which is an international organization based in Paris, that basically is so toothless and so full of loopholes that it won't require ECAs to change anything or do anything. We've been successful so far in getting the United States, of all countries, to oppose it, and the United States actually wants a stronger agreement, believe it or not. But I think time is running short, and there's only a matter of months, perhaps, until the United States caves in and agrees to it. And I have to single out, unfortunately, one country, and it's quite surprising to many people, that is the most obstructionist and has the most negative impact on this entire issue, and that's Germany. Germany's Export Credit Agency is one of the worst, and it's called Hermes, their main export credit agency. It was involved in financing the Three Gorges Dam, the Terry Dam in India, some very, very bad projects. And more than that, it's the most obstructionist countries in these international negotiations trying to come up with reform for export credit agencies. It's sort of the ringleader of a group of European countries that basically doesn't want to do anything. So, it's a big problem, and there are a number of efforts underway to do something about it, targeting the G8, targeting the OECD, national governments, parliaments, the export credit agencies themselves. There's a lot of research that still needs to be done on the issue, media work, publicity, lobbying, and coalition building. I mean, the other movements that this issue has implications for, the debt movement, arms control, the anti-nuclear movement, the environmental movement, development groups, human rights groups. I mean, we need to sort of work together and make the linkages between all of these issues. We need to organize on campuses and in communities, and fundamentally we need to make this an issue that people know about, because unless people know about it, governments feel no pressure to change, and they aren't changing. And I just want to give you a couple websites where you can go for more information. There should be some flyers if they're not gone in the back. But one website is ECA Watch, and that's ECA-watch.org. And there's actually a listserv on that website that you can sign up for. And another website is my organization's environmentaldefense.org. And we have an internet action network as well that you can sign up for and say that you're interested in international issues and become involved that way. And I'm happy to answer any questions or talk to anybody about it as well.
Okay, thank you very much. Aaron, could you just please explain us really briefly, like in one sentence, what do you understand by moral hazard? Maybe a lot of people don't know this term, including me. Or maybe I'm the only one, but just a sentence.
It's not so easy, actually. Moral hazard is just when a governmental institution or an insurance company or anybody is absorbing the risk from any potential event, then it increases the likelihood that people will undertake risky behavior, because they don't bear the downside, they don't bear the costs if something goes wrong. So they have every incentive to just, you know, light lots of fires in the house because they have a fire insurance policy or whatever it might be.
Thank you. I will give over to Mara, and we will hear how the debt crisis...
This campaign has shown what we can do when nonviolent street activists, pop stars, popes, and politicians work together. We got a result. But our ultimate goal is more systematically an economically just world. I've just been in Uganda where debt relief is working, so creditors must do more of it. But even complete debt cancellation won't free up all the money Uganda needs for basic human needs. The same goes for most impoverished and marginalized African countries. If we are going to win this war on justice and poverty, we need to campaign to drop more debt, but also to level more effective aid and trade more fairly. Debt, aid, and trade has a melody line which must be heard by all. Because in Longway's Central Hospital, where three patients wait in the same deathbed, they are still waiting for the Jubilee, and we cannot fail them. And he says to those that are in the World Social Forum, he's sorry he can't be in Brazil. He has to go to the Super Bowl to perform, which is his day job. From Bono. So sorry to interrupt with that. There was a slight hope. So I just want to start. I don't know how many people here saw the State of the Union address the other evening. I'm sure we all found it quite charming. I'm trying to see where my notes went since I was pulled away with all the Bono stuff. That's right. The state of the world and said to the state of our union, we might not find it so strong. And when we gather here today, what we find is that the state of our world, there's many problems that we all need to face together. Every single day we have 29,000 children dying from preventable disease and hunger. That's about every time we breathe in a day. We have 25 million people that have died from AIDS in Africa. So far, that's as many people as has died in all of Europe during World War II. We're looking at one of the greatest pandemics that is going to take over the death tolls, greater than the Black Plague that we saw in Europe. We live in a world where of unprecedented wealth and prosperity accumulated in an unprecedented small number of hands. We have seen growing inequality along with growing prosperity. We live in a world where two-thirds of the world, the two-thirds world, is burdened by tremendous debt that it is played as a mechanism to suck out resources from the very poorest people in the world and as a mechanism of control. So as we come together today to assess the state of our world, I think we have a lot to think about on our hands. And we've gotten some wonderful presentations from Neil and from Aaron, and I just want to give a little general overview of what we talk about as the debt crisis, and why is debt, this abstract economic concept, so intricately linked to the state of the world that I just began to describe. And when we talk about the debt history, we can sometimes go back to the 1970s, and I don't want to go into too long of a history because many of us may already know it. But what we saw was private banks that pushed loans on the very poorest countries, all during the 1970s. And oftentimes with no accountability of how that money would be used, how it would be paid back, and if it would be to the benefit of the people in those countries. We saw those loans pushed on countries at flexible interest rates. So they might have taken them out as low interest rates, but at the end of the 1970s and early 80s, you saw interest rates going up to 20, 26%. And all of a sudden, countries find themselves in a situation, right, just 10 years maybe coming out of colonialism. And here they have all these loans, weren't given accountably, not knowing what to do with it, and interest rates go so high that countries literally cannot even pay interest rates. So what is a country to do? They take out more loans to finance the interest rates on the old loans. And in the early 1980s, it began to become clear to the international community, especially beginning with the 1982 default, or almost default, threatened default of Mexico on their debt. And we saw a process put into place of a variety of plans that were designed to help the private banks, not the countries, the private banks get out of what they might have lost by those loans given throughout the 70s. So what Aaron's talking about in what I see the most egregious part of ECAs, the ECAs, is taking what is really a private debt or a private risk and then moving it to public ledgers. We've already seen this happen all throughout the 1980s when private debts from private banks were either bought up by the United States through mainly two processes, through the Brady Plan and the Baker Plan, when banks were given tax relief to the equivalent cost of the debts that were loaned. And then those loans were then taken up and owed then to the United States government, or they were come in and bought up by the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. So you saw a transition of countries mostly being indebted to the private sector. Private sector was bailed out. And countries, still just as indebted, now mostly indebted to bilateral creditors, including ECAs, countries, and increasingly the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. So we found ourselves during the 1980s, and then particularly the 1990s, where countries had such incredible debt burdens. In Africa, you were looking at situations, and during the 1990s, I think the statistic comes from 1996, where African countries on average spent four times more servicing their debt than they did on healthcare and education combined. We actually saw in the late 90s less children in school in Africa than in 1980, because so many resources were diverted from healthcare and education in order to service these debts. And that's really when you see the World Bank and IMF stepping in to play a role, becoming the primary creditors, or the creditors, the preferred creditors, meaning they're the creditors that have to get paid first from the very poorest countries. And they were able to continue to loan to countries at very low interest rates. So countries found themselves in this trap of such an incredible amount of indebtedness that they can literally becomes unpayable. And the debt is used as a mechanism through which to force countries to undertake the structural adjustment policies that Neil so clearly articulated. The Jubilee campaign is one that I would think is quite tremendous. Started in the late 90s and came with the idea that there should be a way to break countries out of the cycle of indebtedness that was causing so many problems of tearing down health infrastructure, requiring countries to take on these reforms that Neil indicated, primarily in order to get the resources to pay back these debts. So the Jubilee campaign really took its inspiration from scripture, from what was talked about in the Old Testament in Leviticus. Now, isn't this fascinating? Here we are, the late part of the 20th century, looking to ancient texts and ancient times for solutions to world economics. And the idea behind Jubilee is that every 50 years is a time to proclaim Jubilee, and it's the holiest time, the holiest year talked about in scripture. And the idea is that in that year, all debts are canceled, slaves are set free, and land is returned to its original owners. So it's really quite an amazing concept that somehow this would be the most holy time, the most holy way to honor God by restoring equality and balance into the world. So the Jubilee took its inspiration from this scriptural concept. So what if we could have a Jubilee year in the year 2000 and cancel the debt and set the people free? So as we know, it's now the year 2002. The Jubilee campaign made a tremendous amount of success. We moved the issue of debt from being a non-starter conversation. I remember 4 years ago when you would literally be laughed out of the room when you wanted to talk about debt cancellation for poor countries. To becoming an official World Bank and IMF program, to being funded by Congress, to being supported by Republicans, Democrats, Bono, the San Francisco 49ers football team, Pat Robertson, you name it, got a whole bunch of folks coming together to support this idea of canceling the debt so that money can be used for education and healthcare. And so where have we come with that? We've seen a lot happen. About a third of the debts of some 25 countries so far has been canceled. It's much less than a Jubilee, but it is beginning to have results. In the country of Uganda, they've used that money and have been able to double enrollment of kids in school in the matter of 2 years using those resources. In Tanzania, they have finally reached their completion point and have gotten the full of their debt cancellation. And they abolished the user fees, like Neil said. Now we have thousands of kids lining up to go to school in Tanzania. In Honduras, they've been able to offer 3 more years of school into junior high school for kids that would have never had an opportunity to go to junior high school. In Mozambique, 500,000 children have been vaccinated against diseases that could have killed them before their 5th birthday. So what we're seeing is that it can work, but there's a number of problems. And one of the biggest problems is that the World Bank and IMF are continuing to insist that countries comply by their structural adjustment policies in order to receive the money for debt cancellation. So, and oftentimes, and I want to just read a few examples because I really find it quite startling when we're talking about a program that's designed to free up funds to reduce poverty, the kind of requirements that countries have to go through in order to just get that small amount of funding. We're talking about only a third, about on average, of relief of these debts. So, example in Chad, where the life expectancy is 44, the government has still not received their debt relief because they haven't listed price controls on petroleum and they have to privatize telephones, roads, electricity, and the cotton sector, which they're not doing fast enough. In the country of Mali, where the life expectancy is 51, they're going through a substantial drought. Their debt relief is delayed because of slowness, again, in privatization of cotton, telecommunications, water, and petroleum. In Rwanda, where 11% of the adult population is affected with HIV and AIDS, they haven't gotten their debt relief yet. Why? Because they have, for some reason, gone through with some of the privatization mechanisms, but they are still above the funding target cuts that the IMF wants for them to cut back in healthcare and education and cut back in their budgets. In Malawi, where the life expectancy is 40, they haven't gotten it. Why? Because they're, again, slowness and privatization of their public industries. In Benin, life expectancy of 54. Slowness again. Why? Because slowness and privatization, including water. And I think this water piece is just so important, and Neil touched on it. I mean, just think about what that is. Every single person has to have clean water. I mean, we could make it maybe for a week without food, but without clean water, cannot have begin to have a healthy society. We've seen in Africa and South Africa when they privatized the water, the cholera epidemics went right up. Neil was just telling me amazing stories about Ghana. Ghana just got a $60 million new loan from the World Bank in order to help them privatize, beef up, and then privatize their water sector. Right, a loan that the people of Ghana will have to pay back, $60 million, in order to privatize the water system so they can't drink water. And they're finding in the rural areas where water is being cut off that, what is the disease called?
Guinea worm
is coming up. That's similar to cholera, Neil was telling me. It's a horrible digestive disease that was eradicated and now is coming back again. So what we're seeing is that there's a certain amount of progress that's happened with the debt issue, but it has not been a full jubilee. We haven't provided that release of the control that the debt gives the wealthy countries over these economies. And at the heart of the concept of jubilee is really restoring right relationship. It's about release of power. And I think when we get right down to it, when we talk about the debt, we're talking about the power and the control that the creditors wield over the two-thirds world. And so what we've seen some increases in kids in school and healthcare and lives literally that have been saved because of this and for no other reason. We need to be able to get to a place where we can call for 100% debt cancellation that won't be conditioned on these kinds of reforms. So what we're seeing with the ECAs is really a repeat of what happened with the history of the debt crisis beginning in the 1970s and 1980s. And I think that that is something to be of great concern. And I hope that many of us will learn more about it and begin to see how we can draw the connections in this way. But there's a lot of hope also as well. The Jubilee movement is strong and growing around the world, even after the end of the year 2000. We have a very excited legislative campaign coming up this year. And I hope that everybody in this room, as besides participating in forums and participating in street protests, will really think about joining us and contacting your members of Congress about this legislative opportunity this year. I don't think we've seen anything quite like it before. The World Bank is coming in front of the U.S. Congress this coming spring to ask for a replenishment of this IDA arm, to ask for funding, U.S. taxpayer funding, to replenish their work. And this is the 13th time they've done it. They only come every 3 or 4 years, and so we call it IDA 13. That's our insider language for it, IDA 13. And what we have gotten a coalition together in Washington, D.C. is to condition that money from our taxpayers to further the World Bank on 100% debt cancellation from the World Bank and IMF for the very poorest countries, and a variety of reforms of the most egregious parts of their structural adjustment policies, especially the ending water privatization. Ending water privatization as a condition for future loans or for further debt relief. Ending the way the World Bank has insidiously gone after labor standards and minimum wages. Finally closing the loopholes to end the user fees on healthcare and education. And a variety of others, we have it back. But basically every single group, including environmentalists, to put together an amazing list of conditions that we want to do it. So we're going to introduce this legislation this spring. So what that means is there is a legislative vehicle right this year that's going to be moving in Congress that every single person that has a concern about anything that the World Bank is doing can get behind because it includes labor, environment, debt cancellation, health and education issues. And it's really a phenomenal opportunity that we have to try to push something like this through. And the U.S. Catholic Conference and the AFL-CIO, all the main environmental groups, are all coming together in a coalition that I don't think we've seen this strong before in D.C. So I just want to make people excited about this because I think street protest is very, very important. And I also want us to try to engage on these issues with our legislators. I know we're getting to the end of the time here, and I hope we'll have some fruitful discussion and conversation. But I just think that there is a lot of hope in order, you know, for ordinary people to come together and really see some changes in these policies. And I don't know how each of you got inspired to be in this room or inspired to do this work, but I'll say that for myself. When I lived abroad, in college, studied in Colombia, and you know, the real concrete experiences of being people that are suffering because of these policies is just still in my heart. And I just have to bring that into the room every time that I speak, because I think sometimes we can just get into talking too much about statistics otherwise. But I remember really clearly when I lived in Colombia, I worked with women and children in the shanty towns outside of the city. And this one time just is so poignant to me, because I was working with the kids and I asked them to all draw pictures of their homes. So I wanted to see what would the picture, you know, here they're all living, you know, sewage is literally running down the street. All of the kids had amoebas, you know, incredible poverty conditions. And I just wanted to see, you know, how would the kids draw their pictures. And the most amazing thing happened is that almost all of the little kids drew pictures of the green countryside. The green countryside with cows and with a river. And I was so confused because where are these images coming from? And when I had conversations with the kids, what I found out is that almost all of them had previously lived in the country where their families had farms. They had their own farms. They had lived in the country where they had access to clean water. And because of the IMF and World Bank conditions on Colombia to increase its exports, the exports, you know, of bananas and coffee, et cetera, these families had been pushed off of their land and were now living in the shanty towns outside of the city trying to find work. And so what I realized in that moment, and what I hope all of us have had experiences realizing, is that these policies affect real people's lives. When we talk about 29,000 children dying every day, when we're talking about people with names, with hopes, and with dreams about what they want to do with families, we talk about 25 million people that have died from AIDS, and we're going to continue to let that happen. And I just think about what kind of a world are we living in when there is the moral vacuum that we can allow it continues to happen. And I think as a movement, we really need to start talking about this. And I know that this is a very sensitive issue, but I'm really longing for someone to say this, so I'm gonna say it. There's been so much attention to what happened in this city here on September 11th, where 3,000 people died. And it was a horrible, horrible act and a crime against humanity. But 2 days later, $40 billion had been fundraised to deal with that tragedy. Yet we have 29,000 people dying every single day, and we don't have the political will to raise $40 billion that could save these lives. And so what I want us to come together and do is to, we need to start saying that. We need to not be afraid anymore to say that there's a contradiction, and that we won't take that anymore. My hope that we can continue to learn, we can continue to partner, we continue to teach other people about the effects that these policies are having on real people's lives, and then what we can do about it. Because I don't like to come together in a room and talk about issues if there's not something we can do. And I think everyone's presence here right now, and the presence in our protests and learning about new things like ICA, and about participating in the World Bank bonds boycott, which I think is an incredible initiative, and supporting this legislation that's going to come up this next year. But I think we also have to stop being afraid to talk to ordinary people in our communities, in our churches, in our families. And I think it's almost easier sometimes to come out and get on the streets, and even when you're facing against the tear gas, which is horrible, and the threats of police, which is horrible. I actually think sometimes it's scarier to talk to your grandma or to talk to, you know, that person you went to high school with or your neighbor because you're worried, and you think, oh, that's a crazy anti-globalization protester talking about the World Bank and IMF, and there's a fear that we have to do that. So I think we need to really look and break out of that on a daily level. And I just am so hopeful. I'm so hopeful because we've already seen changes occur. We know that if we can generate the political will to cancel the debt, to get the funding that we need for these countries, and to end these policies, I just think we all need to be inspired about what would the world look like when that day occurs. And I believe that it will, and I believe that each of us will contribute to doing that. So thank you so much, and we'll all go out and do it together, and thanks for your great work.
Well, thank you, Mara, Neil, and Erin, for these really touching and exciting examples you gave us. Let me, as a moderator, just add to that. I'm from Switzerland, and we had the same campaign going on, Jubilee 2000, and we were really successful, and it shows that things can be achieved, because all NGOs in Switzerland came together in 1990 and had a big campaign going, and we convinced our president, who was here today, to cancel all bilateral debts, and they did so. And even better, the debts were not only cancelled, but 10% of the debt had to be paid by the government in the south to social projects, which benefited the poor. And we monitored it together with civil society organizations. We made sure that this money would not end up in the central bank, and it would not end up in Swiss bank accounts, and it would not end up in the pockets of rich government people. We made sure that this money really was given back to the people it belonged to. It was invested into hospitals, it was invested into schools, and a lot of social projects. So it is possible. Switzerland is the only country so far which canceled all its debt. It's possible, and it's possible because all people in Switzerland voted for that. We had 4 million signatures for that. That's a lot. And that was 10 years back. And I just want to tell you this example. But please feel free to ask questions now, and let's start the discussion on this really exciting topic. Yes, you were first, I think. Yes, please. We do have microphones up there. Maybe you want to line up there. I hope they work.
I'd like to talk about a question about law enforcement. As was said by Mara, but what can't pronounce that. Thank you. In the early 70s, the various banks, private banks, lent money to a bunch of thieves who stole it. For instance, Marcos in the Philippines and Mobutu in what was then Zaire. And what is being, since most of this money which was lent is actually in Switzerland and the Cayman Islands, what is being done to get this money back to the people who own it, basically, you know? And also all those kleptocrats who seem to be running Indonesia and Algeria and places like that.
I'll just go ahead and start, and then I hope other folks will join in. As far as I know, I don't know if there's, you know, an organized social movement that's calling for getting back the stolen wealth. We talk about it a lot. But what I do know is that there's a growing understanding and conception of these debts, because there's still debts on the books, right? The money's gone. That these debts are odious, that they are actually illegitimate, that should not be paid. And it's not just because the debt shouldn't be paid because it's taking money away from healthcare and education. They shouldn't be paid because they're illegitimate debts on the books. So I think there's a growing understanding, especially coming from the southern countries, but growing in the northern countries, that that debt cancellation is a way to be able to wipe that out. Because at least if the money was lost and stolen and gone, then the people, ordinary people, should not have to pay it back. But I think that there has been talk, and I think it would be an interesting proposition to see what would happen if a social movement actually formed around getting that money back out of the Swiss bank accounts and back. We focus more on saying, look, you know, X percent of the debt, of this debt of a country clearly is stolen wealth and is then illegitimate. I mean, look at what happened with Argentina. 20% of their debt, their unpayable debt that they're, you know, causing this pandemic in their economy, was accrued underneath a military dictatorship that stole most of that wealth. So, I mean, you could at least clearly say that 20% of that should not be paid back as a moral justification. So that's where we are, as far as I know. You all may know more.
Being from Switzerland, I guess I'm answered, I guess. And it's always push and pull factors, actually, you know. So there is a pull factor, which is Swiss banks attracting foreign money. You should not forget that. And so a lot of NGOs in Switzerland are actually working to change legislation in Switzerland and to make banks accountable who they're actually lending money to, and also to make sure that no money from potentates or whatever it's called are taken on board. And actually, just last year, it has improved a lot. I think a lot of money was found from rich, you know, from dictators, especially from Eastern dictators right now. Also, Abacha money was found. And I just know another case I was directly involved in was drug money found. And we formed a coalition to give back to Colombia. And we're working together. It's really a very new and exciting project for the peace movement of Colombia. And we formed a peace group in Colombia where the drug money will go back to.
We are not too far from United Nations. And when you mentioned, Mara, your thing about the legislative goal that is coming, which we all should participate, we all can't participate because I'm not from United States. I would like to know if you have something similar for other OECD countries who are G7 countries who own the big chunk of IMF or World Bank.
I mean, I know the most, of course, about the U.S. because I'm a campaigner in the U.S. But I didn't mean to want to leave out or disrespect our partners here internationally, especially our partners for the South, because there's incredible places for everybody in this work. My understanding is that all of the G7 countries, the richest countries, have made a commitment to cancel the debts of the poorest countries owed directly to their treasuries, and that has actually occurred. The U.S. government has appropriated the full amount of money for that commitment, and that other countries are now lining up to do the same. So I think when we're really looking at the next steps of debt, we need to be looking at the World Bank and IMF particularly. So every country has an important role to play. I mean, I think there's a number of things to find out, you know, what other countries, what other campaigns other countries are doing. But then also, there's been lots of proposals, and this has sort of been circulating at the Financing for Development conference that's been happening across the street, proposals for debt arbitration, for a debt cancellation process, which I find very intriguing, although it looks like they might want to be handling it to the IMF, which would be somewhat like the creditor running the court, the judge and the jury all in one. So we certainly wouldn't support that proposal. But I think that there's a number of initiatives that in the international community can get around supporting. And I think going for some kind of a fair and transparent arbitration process is important. Continuing to call for the debts to be illegitimate and odious, and debt cancellation. And I think citizens in every country has representatives to the World Bank and IMF. And whether their congresses are going to be working on legislation or not, you know, most of them are democratic, you know, parliaments and congresses through which people can work through to influence the policies of the World Bank and IMF, which are run by the rich countries. I mean, they're run by our government representatives that tell them what to do. So that means that everyone, all of us, in at least in the northern countries, can participate in that way.
Yeah. My question, I have two questions. One is, what do you do with countries which are still being governed by dictatorships or by very corrupt regimes? You mentioned the case of Chad. The president of Chad just last year stole the elections when the first money which came in for this oil project in Chad, he used a big part of for buying weapons. So I think in a lot of cases, if the government is still, if it is a military government or a government that doesn't respect the human values, then debt cancellation can even be counterproductive because it can, for instance, free up a lot of money for buying weapons or other means to suppress their own people. The other question is, What do you think is the impact of what's happening now in Argentina on the whole debate on debt cancellation, but also maybe a little bit on the role of the World Bank and probably more strongly the IMF in that?
Let's see if this is on. Yeah, I think on the first point, what do you do? You were asking what to do in the case of military dictatorships, and there are a lot of different positions on this issue. I take, I guess, my personal view on this from groups in the South, Jubilee South, groups that are working on debt, that any kind of conditionality from northern creditors, from the World Bank or the IMF, the G8 governments, is not acceptable. So when you talk about positive conditionality, where you're saying, well, it has to go to, you know, to certain social needs, or it has to go only to regimes that are, quote, democratic, that undermines sovereignty. So I think that's certainly a consideration. I don't know that it's our role in the U.S. as campaigners to be imposing additional conditions, and that rather it's the role of social movements in countries affected by, you know, undemocratic regimes to oppose those regimes and change them. But I mean, people may have different positions on that. On Argentina, I think this is a really clear example of a failure of years of Argentina following the advice of the IMF and World Bank of opening its economy, of privatizing all its major industries and utilities, and now seeing that that model is not, you know, leads to what the crisis it's in now. There have been protests for years against IMF austerity, and right now they're in a very tough spot, right? I mean, in order to just continue, they have to, in some sense, find access to resources, and the only one that they can really go to is the IMF and World Bank, and they're going to be, you know, again forced to deal with some of the same conditions they've had before. It's very difficult for one country to opt out of the system, where, you know, the system which has such concentrated control by this institution.
I'm just going to add that this might be one of the places where Neil and I have some disagreements, or I might have some disagreements with other folks in our network, including my executive director, who would not be happy if she was here today. I think it's a real debate, and I actually think that that in some situations, positive conditions on making sure that the debt cancellation money goes to poverty reduction goals, as long as civil society is actually and really involved in deciding how that money will be spent, I think could be useful. In Uganda, the Poverty Action Fund that was set up in Uganda is a transparent process where the money from the debt cancellation went into this fund, and then they were actually able to see exactly where it went. They said, you know, international community, audit our books. You know, other governments, come and audit our books. NGOs, come and audit our books. And they included the civil society in actually designing where the money would go. Now, the newest loan that the World Bank is giving to Uganda that was supposed to include this, you know, support from NGOs is not taken consideration into it. So the government, I think, has to be friendly to making that happen. But I think it is a real concern, because when we talk about the debt, we're talking about two things with the debt. We're talking about money that's leaving countries that could be used literally right now to save lives and get kids in school. But we're also talking, and I think in the broader picture, about the debt as a tool of power. And so many of the countries in the South are saying debt cancellation is for liberation, it's for justice. It's because the debts are illegitimate, it's because we're using the debts to control them. And so sometimes the concerns that folks in the South, at least that I've heard articulating, come from that space, and it's less of a concern. It's not that it's less of a concern where the money will go, but you can't forget the concern that the debt is also used as a tool. So in that case, I think you have to say it has to be immediate and full and complete debt cancellation, because it's working for the broader understanding. I agree that in some countries, you know, right now, if they were given debt cancellation, might not use it well. But I also think that argument has been used as an excuse, and really just as an excuse, for holding up money for countries that really are ready to use the money in a productive way.
Yes, let me just add, we should not forget that that prevention is,
yes,
a very good measure too. And as Erin pointed out before, you know, we might as well stop the spiral of export credit agencies and the World Bank giving loans which never, or to projects which are not sound, you know, which might just be government people's rich limousine parts or something like that. For example, that was one project the Swiss ECR financed. And I would love to ask you to pose your question.
Sure. We might have suggested this a bit when we just talked about autocratic regimes and their relationship and all of this, but I'm very interested in how the human rights framework and terminology relates to any number of topics. So I was thinking about that in two ways. One of them is oftentimes when you're looking in advocacy circles and such, it's hard to see behind all the terminology, and you'll hear about the export credit agencies and the IMF and human rights violations. It was mentioned how some of the investments and projects led to these kinds of egregious violations in India. I was thinking in terms of maybe a case study or a cause and effect relationship. Can you provide evidence and explain basically how these kinds of practices in effect lead to human rights violations? And then secondly, can we talk about any of the things that we've been discussing in terms of the human rights framework at all, or how would you think about the prospects of that?
Rank, can you give the example of the Ibiza case, or to go to?
Well, every case is different, and all of the really egregious ECA cases have different and horrific examples of human rights abuses. But I can point you to, because it's in the news so much lately, this project in India, this Enron project. Human Rights Watch did a very good 166-page documentation of it. And it essentially involved the local police. A lot of the corruption is alleged. The whole project involved tariffs for the power, for the electricity, that were vastly inflated over what power actually should cost. And so there's a lot of corruption is alleged in the project. Enron probably paid off the government officials to sign this huge project. And then there's a lot of local community opposition to the project, and the police brutally cracked down on that opposition. Arrests, detentions, beatings, et cetera, it's all documented very well in this 160-page report that Human Rights Watch put out. And is on their website. But that's just one example. A lot of times we're referring to involuntary resettlement, where people are evicted from their lands without any consultation or any decent remuneration or compensation of any kind. So it can really be many, many different things. And there are increasing numbers of human rights groups that are becoming involved. The International Federation of Human Rights, based in Paris, and Christine Habard has become increasingly involved in the issue. Human Rights Watch is trying to put through Congress a human rights amendment to the Charter of Export-Import Bank, which is one of the American ECAs, so that they would have to more effectively screen potential projects for potential human rights abuses.
There was a question over there. Did you go over there? I don't know. She did. Okay. Very good.
Me? Yes. Mm-hmm. There's a question for Aaron. Mm-hmm. In relation with the credit agencies, I am surprised when you say that you want to put you are a lobby or campaigning to put these agencies to the level of the World Bank after what Neil say about the World Bank. And when you have the experience of facing a project of the World Bank, you know that World Bank is not accountable. When they said environmental impact studies, they do the environmental studies, which means nothing. They say consultations, and they make consultations, but means nothing. Now, because there is a political difference between the North and the South, the people in the North tend to believe a lot in regulations, in laws, in codes. In the South, the laws mean very little. So when you are campaigning for regulations, for laws, for these things, you are not making a big favor for the people in the South who are struggling certain projects, you know. You are fighting a project either by World Bank or by these agencies, and you push here to have regulations, you are not helping us. So I think my suggestion would be to have a stronger approach to this problem. And I also like to make a comment on the terminology. When the people say corrupt governments, tips, I want to remind the people that corruption is a bilateral thing. You cannot have a corrupt government if you don't have someone who corrupts the government. So I want to say that these countries in the North are also, the governments are also corrupt because they are corrupting someone else. So just to have a bit, to be a bit careful when you point a country and remember what your country has been.
Let me just respond to that. I think that's an excellent point. The second point is extraordinary. And on the first point, we work very closely with lots of communities and organizations in the South, both on the general policy level and on particular projects. And we work very intensely on World Bank issues also, so we know firsthand that the kinds of policies that the World Bank has are not sufficient and often do not work. But it's an entirely different experience when you try to work on a project that's affecting a local community that's financed by an export credit agency. And the export credit agency, nobody releases a single iota of information about the project whatsoever. So neither the local community nor northern NGOs nor anybody really has any clue how to or what to fight. I mean, all I'm saying is that the World Bank situation is horrible, but ECA finance projects can be much more difficult and much harder. So that's one campaign step. But I personally would be extraordinarily happy if there were no ECAs in the world, and if people want to campaign on that, I think that would be great.
Is there more questions on this one? Yes, I saw this one. Oh, this one first, and then back there. And here. Okay.
I have two questions, please. One for Mara and Aaron. If people want to volunteer for your organizations, do you have a place that we can call, contact? Great. And the second one is, what exactly is an NGO?
Non-governmental organization.
Okay.
And there's flyers for Jubilee right out in the front, and I have plenty of cards that I'd be happy to give all of them away.
Oh, great.
And there's tons of volunteer opportunities, so make a just call.
Thank you.
Yeah,
you as well?
The same goes here, and I mean, we're on the web, and our telephone number and website and all of that is on the web, and I can give you a card as well. We're eager for volunteers, and
is it environmentaldefense.org?
Yeah,
ours is jubileeusa.org. We just spent all fall redoing it, so everyone has to go visit because it's my little pride and joy. Our new website.
And NGOs is kind of the lingo for civil society organizations or any sort of community groups or organizations that aren't governmental.
What's yours, Neil?
Thank you.
Oh, yeah, our website. The website for the World Bank Bonds Boycott is www.worldbankboycott.org. The organization I work at is Center for Economic Justice, and that's www.econjustice.net.
Okay, we will repeat the advertising input at the end. Is that okay? He's also prepared to give cards and information. Okay, please continue with the and brochures, you know? Okay, please continue with the questions. I think you have one. Okay.
I'm Tom Reichert, focused on the Global South. First of all, I want to thank the panel. I think you really did a terrific job, and it's one of the best panels I've heard in a long time. But I also had one thing I wanted to bring up that maybe you could...
Could you please, actually, would you mind going to the microphone? I think, you know, we're a bit split, unfortunately, here, and I would appreciate if you could use the microphone.
Hi.
Thank you.
I mean, I think that one of the kind of the proponents of the World Economic Forum and people there, one of their strongest cards is that they always talk about the market and private enterprise. And of course, what you all described is something that's radically opposite, that all these corporations are actually subsidized by taxpayer money. That basically means that we're paying for it, but private profits are generated and private individuals control it. So I was wondering if you could talk a little more about that, because I think that turning that debate around is one of the key things. It basically brings up the question of economic democracy, and it's a kind of longer term goal about everything you're talking about. Thank you again.
Thanks, your organization does great work too. Okay. We love you guys.
Okay, so we continue with questions. I think there was...
Do we want to answer that?
Yeah, maybe we should exit. Yeah. Okay, we should end that.
I think that's really true. I mean, in the case of export credit agencies, it's a massive intervention in the world economy, and it's a huge it's a huge public intervention. It's, you know, it's the same sort of irony that is all over the place, where conservatives and the people who perhaps might be in the World Economic Forum might tout free market ideology and want to reduce regulations and social services and this kind of thing, but then they're certainly benefiting from at least this welfare program. The other aspect, what you raised, the notion of economic democracy, one of the incredible aspects of export credit agencies is just how secretive they are. Many of them release close to no information, period, about any of their activities. And just an incredible example of this is recently the new legislation passed through the Canadian Parliament regarding their export credit agency, which makes it a crime to use the name of their export credit agency, which I'm going to do it now, Export Development Corporation, or the initials or the logo for any business purpose. And that can be defined as, you know, if you're an NGO or a civil society organization, your business is to advocate on issues regarding the public welfare and that kind of thing. So that can be easily interpreted by a court to mean that NGOs or anybody cannot take out an advertisement. Or one particular NGO in Canada has already received a letter from lawyers associated with the Export Development Corporation saying remove the logo from your website, otherwise they'll face litigation. So it's, I mean, there's an extraordinary problem with economic democracy, just as you said.
Yeah, more questions? No?
I would like to ask...
I think he was first. Yeah.
I think I'd like to take a loan out from the Swiss government, because when it comes time to pay them back, I just yell jubilee and I dissolve my debt. And then presumably they give me another loan. And I just continue to do this. And, well, of course, what I'm referring to is damage that could be done to a country that simply defaults on its loan, and that what sane banker would want to give a new loan to this country? And I think in a certain sense, a country that doesn't pay back is damaging itself in the long run. And you just leave it up in the air and don't solve it for me. Okay? Solve it. How do we handle it?
You know, I think if you had like 30 children and really indebted, and maybe you worked for a company and you sort of had good intentions, we could solve your problem. And that's what's happened, you know. A lot of countries, I mean, okay, we might not be speaking about the government elite, you know, because they are all responsible there too. But think of your children, or think of the people living in these countries. They're really poor, as Mara described. You know, they live in incredible situations. And it was not their fault that they were ruled by a dictator, for example. It's not their fault. And when the dictatorship ended, you know, and the democratization process came, because the people fought for it. And so they chased this dictator away. But still, the government could not develop like what's happening in South Africa right now, or in other countries like Zambia, Tanzania, you know, Uganda, for example. Uganda is a good example, because they were left, the good governments with the democratic governments, you know, they were left with millions of debt, which occurred under a dictatorship before. So we have to cancel these debts in order to make our children today have a better world. And I think you would like to have that too. Maybe we should have.
Thank you. I have two questions. One is to Aaron. Who is this Canadian? I'm interested. I'm from Canada. Who is this Canadian NGO who has got this wonderful letter? And if you are not, if you're not forbidden to disclose, please tell us. And
Probe International.
Mm-hmm. I see. Thank you. And Christine, is it true that Switzerland is going to actually join United Nations?
We are a people-based democracy, and so we have elections on that. So all Swiss people will vote on this topic on March 3rd, and keep your fingers crossed that we will.
I'd just like to make a fast observation on the question before this one, the last one, about forgiving the debts, and doesn't that encourage irresponsible behaviour? We tend to forget that a major reason why the debts exploded in the first place was the so-called recycling of OPEC loans. And the second reason, the major reason, was America's attempt to drive inflation out of its system under Volcker's administration, that blasted US interest rates up to about the 17% level and hit the rates in LIBOR over the 20% mark. And that's where a huge part of the debt accumulation came in, because the rest of the world was made to pay for the monetarist experiment in America. And I think that's a very good reason to cancel the debts.
Thank you very much. That was very good and showed how complex the issue is, and we have to know the whole picture. Is there more questions? Two more from there. Yeah. Can you use the microphone, please?
I was wondering if there had been a feasibility study done, or what you can share. Let's say tomorrow all debts are canceled. What is the impact on the various societies of that effect?
I'll just answer for what I know about, which is the very poorest countries. So that wouldn't include countries like India or Brazil or even Argentina, although they've become a special case. But what our colleagues in the UK campaign did is they actually got an independent auditor that they paid in London to audit the books of the World Bank and IMF and find out what would happen to them if they cancel the debt using their internal resources. And what they found is that there is enough profits within the bank and the fund, and that they could easily cancel the debts tomorrow. Some of it, they might have to take the brunt of that cancellation over a number of time, like a period of 20 years. But that actually the World Bank and IMF have enough resources tomorrow to cancel the debt if there was a political will, and it wouldn't cost a single further dollar of taxpayer money. So that's for the World Bank and IMF debt. The as Aaron pointed out articulately earlier, a statistic that I didn't even know, that it was 56% of the debt is owed directly to the ICA, so this means more of the bilateral debt, and I don't have a clear sense of what that would actually do, but because I'm not as familiar with the ICA part. But I think what we have to keep in mind is that even before debt cancellation, the third world debt was around $3 trillion, which sounds like an incredible lot of money, but the debts in the largest countries, Brazil, Argentina, et cetera, is where a lot of that is concentrated. And for the very poorest countries, it's a lot for them, but it's so, so small in comparison to the global economy that I don't think that it would have much of an effect on the economy overall. Now, if you start to ask some of the deeper questions, you guys can say what you think about this. But when we talk about the debt as being a mechanism of control, I mean, if the Jubilee were to occur, right, in the way we envision it and want to work for it and see it happen in our dream, not only would the country stop paying that money, but that would be the end of that power dynamic over those countries. So what that could ultimately mean in the world could be much more, it could be a lot more. Countries could start saying, we don't want to sell you oil at such cheap prices. We're not going to sell off all our gold and minerals to you for nothing. You know, so that could have more of an effect. But as far as the actual amount of money canceling it, they could do it tomorrow and it wouldn't affect their functioning.
Okay, thank you. Okay, wasn't there a lady too? Well, yeah. Okay, please go ahead.
This is for Aaron. Was the Indian Dam project that Enron wanted a project that was funded by an ECA, and if so, which ECA did the funding?
It's a power plant project, and it was financed by the two United States export credit agencies, okay. The Export-Import Bank and OPIC, the Overseas Private Investment Corporation.
Is there more questions?
Yes,
who disappeared. Yes, please.
At first, I just had one comment on the question just before this. I think it is important to remember that inflationary policies of certain countries, in South America, for example, have also been a major reason why debt got out of control. So I think that there are a lot of, reasons and a lot of people who are at fault, but you have to remember that as well. That, as we saw in Argentina, when you tried to get a handle on inflation, well, then you had people rioting because they lost all their jobs to nearby Brazil because, labor was cheaper there. And, they're trying to find a happy medium, but at the same time, it looks like we're going to have another, extended period of hyperinflation there. And so you can't ignore the fact that some of these governments are printing money and contributing to the debt problem. And I just wanted to make that point. And the second question really that I had was that one that I don't think has been totally talked about here, and that is that sometimes these projects, that are development projects that are taking place in these countries, some of them may be necessary. And if we're going to completely, criticize the agencies that are funding them when there are some things, you know, good being done, who do we turn to if not to the IMF? Who's going to give the money to improve the standard of living for some of these people? Because coming from the North, I have a lot of things that I'm sure I take for granted as American, I'm sure a lot of Americans do. I have power plants, I have water treatment plants. A lot of these countries that we're talking about, they don't have those things. And some of these, you know, agencies that are lending money are for those purposes. And yes, there are bad things that are happening, but we also need to work to improve the standard of living of these people, and who is going to do it if not these agencies?
I'll go. I want to hear what Neil has to say too, I hope.
Okay, I think we agreed on you, Neil.
I guess on the second question, actually, I think it's an important question, which is basically, you know, if not the IMF or World Bank, how do these countries get access to resources? And a lot of the development kind of thinkers in the Global South, at least a lot that I've heard talk about, really mobilizing domestic finance for domestic needs, and that is being able to do that in a way where you're not dependent on foreign capital. That's easier in bigger countries like maybe South Africa, Brazil, Argentina, than others. You don't have to be dependent on foreign capital. That's how, you know, in a lot of ways the U.S. and other northern countries develop. So it's not like a historical, you know, certainly there's a historical precedent for it. I think another model like that scholars like Samir Amin and others talk about is regional integration and linking, for example, economies across West Africa to link together and produce for their own countries. I'll give you an example. Senegal, you know, they actually export something like 80% of their exports go to Europe, and another 10% go to the U.S. or something, and a very small percentage go elsewhere in Africa. Countries in Africa don't trade with each other. They're totally dependent on these other foreign, you know, largely northern economies. If you can develop, I think, more regional and, you know, economies where developing countries can create their own markets and work together, they don't have to be so dependent on the U.S. And then that's just some of
I just wanted to add.